ஓம் நம சிவாய. டியர் லிசனர்ஸ் ஆஃப் சைவம் டாட் ஆர்க், தி நெக்ஸ்ட் ப்ரோக்ராம் இஸ் ஸ்பிரிச்சுவல் டிஸ்கோர்ஸ். இன் திஸ் யூ ஆர் அபவுட் டு லிசன் கவாய் ஹிந்து லெக்சர்ஸ். தி டைட்டில்ஸ் ஆர் ரிசல்ட்ஸ் ஆஃப் செல்ஃப் ரியலைசேஷன், தி இம்பார்ட்டன்ஸ் ஆஃப் நோயிங் மகாசிவராத்திரி 2003 பார்ட் 1 அண்ட் 2, பிரசன்டட் பை ஸ்ரீ சிவாய போதிநாத வேலாயுத சுவாமி. தேங்க்யூ. ஓம் நம சிவாய.
One of the great gifts given to us by Gurudeva is the description of God, and in our terminology we call it the three perfections, three different aspects of God. And why is this important? Well, it's important because otherwise it can be very confusing. We read scripture and God is described as a person. We read scripture and God is described as transcendent. We read something else and God is omnipresent consciousness. We read something else and so forth. We can end up kind of confused. We try and worship God Shiva and we run into our confusion. We say, what exactly is the nature of God Shiva? So when it comes to the five actions, of course, this relates to the personal God, Parameshvara, and that's one of the perfections. God Shiva as a person, who can be seen as a person. And Gurudeva's powerful vision of Lord Shiva as a person is what we were fortunate enough to have on our Sanmarga property, where the Svayambhu Lingam is. That's where God Shiva as a person appeared to Gurudeva. And from that, the Harivan temple has come forth. And of course, that's one of the aspects that makes the Harivan temple very special, is it was founded upon a vision. Temples can be founded for many reasons. We want a cultural center, want a place where it's warm, whatever. Temples are founded for many reasons, but when they're founded on a vision, it gives the temple a special quality. The second concept of God is omnipresence, and that's nicely conveyed in Yoga Swami's statement, bliss, 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 here, there, everywhere am I. So in this case, he's identifying himself with the consciousness, which is God Shiva. He calls it an I also. And when we're in that consciousness, because we're attuned to omnipresence, we can't go anywhere or come anywhere. There's no going, there's no coming. There's no movement. We can't travel because we're already everywhere. So Gurudeva would sometimes joke about it. He'd be driving along and tell you that he wasn't moving. That was his way of describing what Yoga Swami was describing. I'm not moving. Nothing's moving because he was already everywhere. So you can't move if you're already everywhere. You can only move if you're somewhere, going somewhere else. Then you have a sense of moving. But in that state of consciousness, there's no moving. We're already there. We can be running down the street, and we're not moving because we're already everywhere. And then Gurudeva has given us the description of Shiva as the transcendent, absolute, Parashiva, identical with Paramatma, the transcendent self. And one of Gurudeva's unique contributions to talking about the self is he describes it so precisely. very hard to think about the transcendent. What does it mean for something to be transcendent? What does it mean for something to be the absolute? So, how does he describe it? Of course, we all know how he describes it. Timeless, formless, spaceless, and causeless. Like the emptiness on the inside of an empty box, which isn't empty, but is the fullness of everything. So the word empty is a very useful word to grab onto. It's an emptiness. It's a fullness. Timeless, causeless, spaceless, formless. So this is very useful in terms of thinking about it, in terms of searching for it, in terms of realizing it, because we have a description. We sit down, we go into the inner light, and we see all this beautiful inner light. We know that's not the self. Even though it's blissful and wonderful, we're not confused. Oh, I found the self. We get into a state of consciousness where we feel everything is one. Oh, this is beautiful. Must be the self. No, we know that's not the self. Because it's something. It's a thing. It's not nothing. It's not empty. So we even have to go deeper than those realizations of light and unity of consciousness to get near the self. So that's a wonderful contribution Gurudev has made. It makes realization of the self a lot easier because it's described so precisely. Well, if it's nothing, how do you know that you've realized it? That's a good question, right? You can't experience it because it's nothing there to experience. So how do you know that something happened? This is a good question, right? Did I realize the self? I sat down, I meditated. Did I realize the self? Well, there are ways of knowing. And one of them is the sense that you've stepped outside of time, form, and space. Stepped out of the universe of time, form, and space, and now you're back in. And furthermore, that when you stepped out of it, that was the reality, and now you're back in the unreality. So, what would an analogy be? An analogy would be like a movie. Some action movie. Action movies can really get you absorbed in the movie. You really, you know, you forget you're sitting in a seat, you forget you're in a theater. You're watching the movie and you're really, really wrapped up in it. So it's like sitting there watching the movie, really, really wrapped up in it, going outside for a minute and then coming back. That's an analogy of realizing the self. And when you come back, you're not looking at it the same way. Because you stepped out for a minute, you have a different perspective on it, right? You're not quite as emotionally involved. You're saying, oh, those are actors up there. And then, you know, maybe after about 10 minutes, you start to get back into it, another 5 or 10, and you're totally wrapped up in it again. You forgot you stepped outside. But at the moment you came back inside the movie from stepping outside, you were aware you had stepped outside. You had a different perspective on the movie. You weren't so attached to it. The movie was going along, which is the fulfillment of karma. But you have a different perspective on it. So the idea is that when you stepped out, that's your real nature. And this is a a seeming. That's the perspective of Parashiva, that it's the reality. And there's no time, there's no form, there's no space, there's no cause. It's just there for you to claim. And as Gurudeva points out in his writings, that ability to realize Parashiva, or shall we be more precise, the regular realization of Parashiva is what brings jnana, brings wisdom. Where does wisdom come from? Does it come from simply worshipping Parameshvara? No, that's where devotion comes from. Not wisdom. Devotion is needed as a prerequisite to wisdom. Does wisdom come from sitting in the bliss of Satchidananda? No, it's blissful. It's much nicer than not being blissful. But it doesn't produce wisdom. Wisdom comes as the aftermath of the realization of Parashiva. So you do that enough times, you build up a little encyclopedia there of inner wisdom. Each time you come out of Parashiva, it's like you have one more page in your encyclopedia of inner wisdom, so to speak. So these days, knowledge is so readily available. You want to know about anything, you search on Google and you find out about it, right? Just, there's a mass of knowledge. It's so available and so fascinating. A good example of knowledge is we saw on television the other night. Doctors were saying, you know, more than half my patients come in having diagnosed themselves and tell me what's wrong with them. They don't tell the symptoms, they tell the disease. I'm suffering from this disease, cure me. It used to be you come in, you say, I have my hand hurts, my head hurts. You know, but these days, there's so much knowledge out there that people look up the symptoms on the web and figure out what's wrong with themselves, at least they think they do. And they go in and tell the doctor, I'm suffering from this disease, please cure me. So, why do I say that? Well, it shows how much knowledge there is and how we fill ourselves up with all this knowledge. Which is okay, but sometimes it's to the exclusion of knowing ourselves. Know thyself. One of Yoga Swami's Mahavakyam. Kanai Pari. My Guru made me to know myself. Engo Gurunavan. First line. So sometimes in these days it's so easy, and education reinforces it. We're spending all our time learning about what's outside of ourselves. We're learning about knowledge, and it's so ramified, it takes up the whole day. We know about everything. We know about health, we know about astronomy, we know about politics, we know about economics, we know about investments. We know about all kinds of things, but we don't know about ourselves. Because no one is encouraging that. Don't encourage that in school. They don't encourage that on television. They don't encourage that in movies. If they're encouraging learning, they're encouraging learning about something external to yourself. So that's where religion is a balancing force. That's where Hinduism gives us wonderful direction. It reminds us, know thyself. Look within and find our spiritual identity. Find our soul. And look within the soul and find God. So that's knowing ourself. Knowing our spiritual identity. As Gurudeva says so beautifully, and it's one of the reasons he was loved by so many, you're a spiritual being. Live a spiritual life. He just exuded that sense. And people that were open to him felt that. That here's a man that looks at himself as a spiritual being, and just by his mere presence encourages me to be the same. Isn't that wonderful? Really unique quality. So many people on the island here have shrines to Gurudeva, you know. I mean, they're Catholics, most of them. But you know, they come in and they tell you about their guru shrine. I have a picture of Gurudeva here in my home, and you know, every day I stop at the picture and share my life with Gurudeva and so forth. It shows how much he touched them. And why? Because of this quality of being a spiritual being and encouraging them to be one, encouraging them to do their best and so forth. We've started a new cult on the island, the Gurudeva cult. Very nice. Very wholesome, because it's encouraging them. They're finding strength to be of more service in many instances. They looked at Gurudeva as an example of someone who's really selfless and love to help other people. And so they find strength in their own life to do more service to others through their ties with Gurudeva. So we're going to have a wonderful week together, culminating in our Mahashivaratri evening. Have a wonderful day. Om Namah Shivaya.
Maybe we could turn that into an Upanishad. Mahashivaratri Upanishad or something. Certainly a beautiful talk by Gurudeva. It's hard to think of what to say afterwards. Fortunately, it's written down. So I don't have to think. But that was the part of it where Gurudeva was just seeing as Shiva. That was certainly very special. So fortunately, our talk tonight ties in quite nicely. You'll see as we go along, it ties in predominantly with Gurudeva's theme that after we express all our love in the temple, after we worship God Shiva with our whole heart and blend with him through the process of devotion, we can keep going. We can find a quiet corner and worship in our inner temple. We can practice meditation, dhyanam, on Shiva inside of us. That's what he was encouraging us to do. So that's what our talk leads up to tonight, that idea. So I think this is a special Shivaratri, and having so many pilgrims come from such diverse parts. Usually we have a much smaller group. When we started, it was just the monks in Gurudeva, and today we're blessed with so many people from so many places all coming and all sharing a love of Shiva that brought you here tonight for this special evening dedicated to Shiva. And we call that Shiva Sambandhan, bound together through Shiva, relatives of sorts, sharing something in common. And in this case, we all share a love of God Shiva that brought us together this evening. As Gurudeva pointed out, Mahashivaratri is Shiva's special night, great night of Shiva. And I was thinking, trying to find an analogy, and came up with one of ozone layer and cosmic rays, which is interesting. Holes in the ozone layer, the bigger the hole, the more the cosmic rays come in. Of course, that's bad, right, in that context. But there we are, looking out in space from Earth. We have this little ozone layer there, and it protects the cosmic rays, bounces them off, most of them, except when we get a hole, and then they come through. So that if we compare that to the spiritual worlds, it's the same thing, but it's going inside instead of going outside. That the barriers between the worlds lessen at certain times. It's like opening a hole in the ozone layer. And instead of cosmic rays coming through, these are Shiva's rays, divine rays of blessings from the inner worlds, come through this hole. So what causes the hole to open? Well, an auspicious night, such as Mahashivaratri, just by itself creates a very big hole. So lots of blessings are flooding through from this inner hole. But the ceremony itself widens the hole. The beautiful chanting of the priest, the chanting of Sri Rudram, takes this hole that's already there and makes it bigger. So we get even more blessings coming through. Furthermore, the devotion of those present widens the hole even more. The more devotion they feel, the bigger the hole gets. So all of us working together create this very special vibration, very special event whereby from the inside out, we have all of this, all of these blessings coming, all of this energy coming from God Shiva and the inner worlds, changing us in ways that we can't even imagine, as Gurudeva talked about briefly there, cleansing us, purifying us, changing our karmas, mitigating our karmas, changing our futures, and so forth, in very dramatic ways, just because we opened ourselves up to it through our devotion on Mahashivaratri. So that's not in the script, as you can tell. Moving on. So Mahashivaratri is nicely described in Dancing with Shiva. We're doing it all. Chanting Shiva's names, we did that. Singing his praise, we did some singing. Chanting Sri Rudram, we did that. Bathing the Shiva Lingam is coming up. So, of course, these are common forms of worship done wherever Shivaratri is held, and we're doing them all here this evening as well. But it goes on. Meditating is the next one. And the last one, being near the monks as they strive to realize Parashiva. It's right in Gurudeva's definition of Shivaratri. What a very interesting way of describing it. So most places you go, you don't find meditation going on. It's not part of Shivaratri. But for the completeness of the experience, as we did tonight, we meditated. First we worshipped. We worshipped Shiva through the Homa ceremony, and later we'll worship Shiva through Abhishekam and Archana. But we also worshipped Shiva inside of us, as the Divine Self inside of us. So, it's a unique part of our ceremony here, something I never really thought about as much till I read it, and we just do it, you know. We focus on the transcendent aspect of Shiva, meaning the monks, trying to realize Parashiva, trying to touch into that part of Shiva which we always are, and as Gurudeva spoke, it was a large part of his talk there. One of the themes of his talk was the transcendence of Shiva and claiming that part of you which you already are. Don't have to become it. You are that. So we're all having an opportunity tonight, and what is the benefit of being near the monks as they strive to realize Parashiva? Well, it can quicken our own spiritual life. It's not that we're going to sit there and become enlightened just because someone across the room is having a good meditation. No. But it can quicken us, it can inspire us, kind of speed up our impetus, help us move along a little faster on the spiritual path than if we hadn't been there. We may not notice, but we pick up some speed. Maybe we were slacking slightly. We get back to normal speed, or maybe we were going along fine and makes us go along a little faster. But in any case, it's a very positive experience, helping to inspire us, even unknown to ourselves, to move along faster. So as part of our many wonderful guests, we have quite a few from Canada, and some of whom are very close to Siva Yoga Swami and the Kailasa Parampara, and we're very happy about that. And we're preparing to go to Toronto in April, And because Toronto is snowing and 20 and 30 degrees, I'm saying we're warming up for the Toronto trip by our talk tonight. Don't want to go there without warming up first. So we're going in April, and the reason we chose that date, even though it's still a little too cold for our Hawaiian blood, is that it's the time of the annual Mahasamadhi ceremonies for Sivayogaswami. It's the Ashlesha Nakshatra on April 11th. So we wanted to be there for that celebration. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. We're also getting ready, working on trips to Mauritius and Malaysia in August at the time of Ganesha Chaturthi. We always visit Mauritius and our center there at Ganesha Chaturthi time because we have a special Ganesha Mandapam. And we're getting ready for our biggest journey, which is a little less than a year from now, and that's our India Inner Search in the middle of January 2004, which is about 3 weeks in length. Very wonderful program we're developing, which has a nice balance to it. Sometimes our programs have been almost all pilgrimage, but this program is providing a nice balance between daily classes, pilgrimage to the major temples, and a nice selection of the best of dance and musical and other cultural traditions of South India. So we're going to mix together all three elements pretty much on a daily basis and keep the traveling down too. We're staying just in a few places and not jumping on a bus every day to go somewhere different. So we're starting to get some enrollments in for that program, and if you're interested, you can contact Sadhaka Dandapani while you're all here and assure yourself a place. So back to Toronto. So the reason we want to focus on Yogaswami, there's a very large Saivite community there in Toronto, and we wanted to talk about Saiva Siddhanta and use Yogaswami as an example, both in terms of how he lived Saiva Siddhanta as well as how he taught Saiva Siddhanta. Because he's an excellent example of a Siva Bhaktar and a Siva Yogi at the same time, in the same person. He's a great devotee of Lord Shiva, has tremendous devotion for Lord Shiva. He's also a great yogi, someone who can meditate profoundly. So this particular combination of devotion and meditation that Gurudeva was talking about also is pretty much unique to the path of Saiva Siddhanta. And the other Hindu traditions usually emphasize just one or the other. Either it's important to be a great bhaktar, a great devotee, or it's important to be able to meditate profoundly and worship internally. However, Saiva Siddhanta requires both of us, not just one or the other. In fact, deep devotion to God is considered a prerequisite to meditation, meaning profound meditation. It's not that we can't sit and have a simple meditation if we don't have a lot of devotion, but it's rather if we're really serious about meditation and want to make good progress, really go into the depths of ourselves, first we have to cultivate devotion. So Saiva Siddhanta, as most of us know, but I'll mention it anyway because some of us aren't familiar with the terms, describes the spiritual path in four progressive stages. First one is Charya, virtuous conduct and selfless service. Kriya, devotional practices. Yoga, which is meditation. And Jnana, which is enlightened wisdom. So I'll read just Gurudeva's statement about the relationship between devotion and yoga from Dancing with Shiva. Hinduism demands deep devotion through bhakti yoga in the Kriya Pada, softening the intellect and unfolding love. So that's the outcome of the Kriya Pada, or the practice of devotion. It softens our intellect and helps us have a deep love. Yoga, union, is the process of uniting with God within oneself, a stage arrived at through perfecting Charya and Kriya. So as we mentioned, Siva Yoga Swami exemplified these teachings in his life. He's certainly a great yogi, and he'd sit for hours at a time, and during some periods of his life, he would sit for days at a time in deep meditation, a real profound meditator. He also has the knack of, just like Gurudeva, of explaining profound metaphysical spiritual concepts in very simple language. It's one of the beauties of Gurudeva's teachings. Doesn't use a lot of complex terminology. It's very simple. Life is meant to be lived joyously. Can't mistake that, what it means. So Yoga Swami has one of these statements, and it's called a Mahavakyam. There's four of his statements that are so considered great sayings, his core teachings. This one is in Tamil, Suma Iru, something parents say to their children all the time, you know, be quiet. Be quiet. So it has a very practical sense, because it's just something that's part of life, you know. Parents are telling children, be quiet. Teachers are telling students, be quiet. Yoga Swami is telling Saivites, be quiet. So it's so simple, but yet it's so profound also. And that's a wonderful part of his teachings, Gurudeva's teachings, and the parampara. In fact, this teaching is so central. There's a center, the Sivathunda Nilayam on KKS Road in Jaffna, two-story building. So downstairs is where most of the activities take place. That's where you sing and you eat, you talk. Upstairs, silence only. The whole second story of the building, you're supposed to be quiet. Even when Guru Puja is done there, there's no bell. No bell at all. It's quiet. So the building itself, when you're upstairs, you're quiet. Be still. When you're downstairs, you don't have to be still. So it's symbolic, as we'll see.